This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The bells of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Pope John Paul II was entombed in an underground crypt at the Basilica Friday. NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore joins us to talk about this and the wealth of so much other news this week. Hello. Good morning, Dan.
Yes, good morning, Scott.
The largest funeral in Vatican history. Some people say the largest funeral in modern times. There were at least 200 heads of state among the mourners, including many who are usually at odds with one another. What does the scale of this funeral, the intensity of emotional reaction to Pope John Paul II, his life and legacy, say about what he represented in these times?
Interesting. Ready for my little homily. It certainly was the largest funeral in modern times. That's certainly maybe the largest gathering of people in history, especially if you count those who were connected around the world by large screen television. Who was he? Well, he was in the first place a media age religious leader, a superstar who had mastered the art of employing 20th and 21st century communications to the spreading of the gospel. I'll leave the people more versed than myself to analyze his religious legacy in terms of doctrine and so on, and clinging to traditional doctrine, even while opening his arms to people of all religions or no religion. Mm-hmm. Interesting that in his testament, the one person mentioned there was the Grand Rabbi of Rome, which was part of reconciliation there. Interesting is the impact that Pope John Paul may have on political life in America. You know, American life has tended to be divided on religions between Catholics and Protestants. And I think now what he has done is to make it so that it's divided more by the observant and the non-observant, that all Christians, all Jews, and so on. But the point is to be a part of that. It was interesting that President Bush, on his way home, spoke of this is one of the highlights of his presidency, and he said that it strengthened his belief in a living God. It's sounding a little bit like a religious leader himself. I think what's maybe missed in all of this, I know I'm going on rather long, but I'm coming to an end, what's missed in all of this is that he was also a very strong critic of capitalism, especially as exercised in America. The American putting a lock on all the raw materials and the energy in the world and leaving other people out. In the Yankee Stadium, I remember, he talked about the beggar Lazarus who was turned away from the table by those too rich. And I think that's the other side of the Pope that our politicians don't like to talk about.
Let us move on to events elsewhere in the world, because in Iraq there was some progress made toward the formation of interim government. Mr. Talabani, the leader of the Peshmerga, the ethnic Kurd party, was sworn in on Thursday as interim president, and he quickly named a Shiite, Ibrahim al-Jafari, as the interim prime minister.
Yeah.
So what we would call in the United States a split ticket.
Mm-hmm.
What does this represent in the formation of a government, and what are they going to go to work on first?
Well, a little premature. He still has to form a cabinet, and there's still some problems coming up. Muqtada al-Sadr is back, the firebrand, organizing demonstrations. Today is the second anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, and that's being commemorated by those who continue to support Saddam Hussein. I think that the new...
I think a lot of those demonstrators actually called for Saddam Hussein to be put on trial immediately.
Oh, then I missed reading it. Thank you.
Oh, we help each other out, Dan. That's why there's two of us.
That's right. All right. I think that the new Prime Minister Shafri has named his priorities. In the first place, security, which is very important to try to do something about it. Political independence, economic prosperity, guaranteed freedoms, participation in the whole spectrum of Iraqi. That's a pretty good bill to try to fill. The question now is if they can. I'll tell you. Every once in a while, I think the thing is dying, is getting stuck in the mud, and not going anywhere. Yeah. And about the time I'm ready to give up on Iraq, suddenly there's a big lurch forward, yeah. as they did with the election, as they did with the election of the president, as they did now the election of the prime minister. So I'm not going to make any big predictions about whether this is going to work or not. Yeah. Just could.
Well, let me ask you about one idea that President Talabani floated, which is offering amnesty to insurgents, many of whom are Sunnis who were, to say the least, empowered under the former government.
Yes, and they've been offered different places in the government and all the rest. They really are trying to bring it together. The interesting thing is those people who talked some time ago about this would be inevitably a civil war among these warring religious factions hasn't quite happened. Mm-hmm. The Kurds have come together, and there's really a question of the Sunnis, who are a minority, and the minority which is more disposed towards Saddam Hussein than any. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, all I do is sit back and say, well, give it a chance.
Okay. Let me ask you about factionalism in the U.S. Congress, because some President Bush's nominees for key positions are facing opposition. There's Lester Crawford at the Food and Drug Administration, who's being pressured to make a decision on over-the-counter sales of the morning-after pill. Before his nomination will be considered, Stephen Johnson, Environmental Protection, is being criticized for not ending a study in which paid families to allow researchers to study the effects of pesticides on their children.
Yes.
And Mr. Bush's nominee for U.N. Ambassador, John Bolton, seems to be the subject of the most focused opposition. His confirmation hearings are scheduled to begin on Monday.
Yes.
How do you estimate how these battles are going to shape up?
Well, there's this constant threat that comes from the Republicans. They say that the filibuster has been abused to keep their candidates from being confirmed. And if that goes on, the threat is something called the nuclear option. Mm-hmm. I won't go into a lot of detail on that, but the option is supposed to consist of getting a ruling from the chair, then upheld by a simple majority vote, and that is sort of the end of the filibuster. There's great hesitation about doing that because someday Republicans may require the use of the filibuster. But that's going back and forth, and Democrats are saying that they're asserting their right in certain cases to put an individual hold, mm-hmm. as Senator Boxer has done his own, and they can do that. Question is, how angry are the Republicans going to become about that, and whether they will then drop their nuclear bomb.
Mm. Is there, which is a parliamentary phrase, we should say, nobody, at least no one in the Congress is probably going to drop a bomb. Is there something ironic or incongruous, whoever I mean it, in having Democrats, which once opposed a filibuster during the civil rights movement, except for the old Southern ones who used it, and Republicans now arguing that they want to get rid of the filibuster?
Well, yes, as in the case of civil rights, the filibuster is a weapon for the minority. It is a way of holding up action, and it's used by whoever seems to be out of power.
Thanks very much, Dan Shore.
Sure.